Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. We hope you're staying cool out there in this 100-degree weather. And today we have a very special guest and somebody who I have looked up to as a mentor for many years and has helped teach me everything I know about recruiting and HR, Sharon O'Donnell. Sharon, thank you so much for coming to the show today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so for our listeners who may not know you, let me tell them a little bit about your background and your history. Sharon is an experienced human resources professional who started her career in Los Angeles and actually worked for HBO. She then went on from HBO and became an HR manager with a top law firm here in California and eventually grew into the vice president of human resources at a growing national real estate development company based in Beverly Hills. Currently, she has a very fun job that she gets to manage the HR department of an international animation studio based in Hollywood with more than 300 employees at studios in Los Angeles, New York, and Canada. So Sharon, thank you so much for being here today. And I'm excited to have your expertise here because we've thus far on the show had a variety of different people ranging from a career counselor and life coach, Allison Garrido, and then we had Kelly McGuire last week, who's more of a social media maven and stylist. And so today, what I'm happy to speak with you about is a little bit, we're going to start with what to do once you've gotten that offer. I think your background with having over 20 years of human resources experience sitting on the other side of the desk where you're the one who determines whether or not somebody gets the job, I think that you can bring a lot of value to this conversation about how to negotiate your compensation once you've gotten that offer that you really want with a company. And we're going to talk as well a little bit about your career. And once you get that first job and you've gotten the salary you want, what it looks like to build your career, and also what employers look for promotions, for raises. And I think I'm looking forward to having you share with us, especially in this market right now, now that it's flipped from an employer to an employee market, a little bit about how do you negotiate a raise in this economy? That's a question I get asked all the time. A lot of job seekers out there feel underemployed after having been hired in 2008, 9, 10, or 11, where they got undervalued at the market. Mm-hmm. So Sharon, tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are. If somebody comes in and you found your ideal candidate, so you're on the hiring side of things, you've identified somebody who you really like, what do you find you respond well to? If somebody is coming in and they're trying to negotiate compensation, is that even acceptable for somebody to try and negotiate an offer when you give it to them?
Well, I think it's always acceptable to question it, but it depends on what you're basing your number on. What I do as a representative of the employer is I have a range. I never want to start somebody at the high end of the range because I want them to grow within that position and for us to have some movement within the range to be able to accommodate a stellar performer, for instance. At the animation company where I'm at right now, it's a little bit different because it's project-based employment. So the producer has worked out a budget with our client, and so the producers know exactly what their range is for each position. So it's a little more detailed because the projects last anywhere from a month to 2 years, or depends on how long the project is.
Interesting. Okay. So say, for example, perhaps when you were working at the real estate company or at HBO or the law firm, if you had a candidate, and let's say hypothetically you had a legal assistant, and that person was offered a salary of $60,000, but you knew you had a little wiggle room in your budget, maybe to go up to $65,000 or $67,000, what do you think would initiate or elicit a positive response from you on the employer end if somebody's coming back and trying to negotiate that with you?
If I've already had conversations throughout the recruiting stage of the salary, and then they come back at the end and say, well, how about a little bit more? I really feel like they've taken me down the path a little bit. I don't like that. If we've never talked about salary except in sort of vague terms, then it's an open field. And I think people like you coach the legal assistants, especially, into the proper stance. So they'll say, well, let's wait until we're further along or whatever, and won't be cornered into talking about money prematurely, which I think is fine. So then let's say we've gone through all of the interviews and the person is, I'm ready to offer them a position. And I look at the range that I have, and as we both discussed, I'm going to give them a midpoint of the range. So let's say I say 60. The wise person who's been around the block a couple times understands there's some give in that. So what they're saying is maybe, well, I was at 59 at my last. 60 is not really a huge bump up. I really feel that my increased experience merits more. You're looking for somebody who's going to be able to move into that seat immediately and perform immediately. And I really believe I can do that. I'm much more impressed with that person's argument and willing to go up a little bit more, because it's a cogent, business-oriented argument. If somebody says, well, I really can't make my bills, well, that's kind of not my problem. I'm sorry. I don't want to sound cold about that. But you have to put that in terms of why are you selling that to me? What makes me want to, as a representative of the company, and I have my own supervisors to answer to and budgets to be concerned with. So then I need a real reason, because I'm going to have to take that up and support it when I talk to somebody about my budget.
Yeah, we're seeing, it's a very interesting climate right now, because we're seeing a lot of offers come up, and so many companies are offering counter offers, and candidates are often getting significant raises and bonuses, and it's all happening at the same time. I think employers are holding on for dear life to the employees that they may know are undervalued. Yes. Right now, and so they know they're out there shopping around. And do you ever do counter offers, or had you ever done counter offers in the past?
Oh yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, what I counsel, let's say I'm hiring somebody, I'll keep it in the legal world, I'm hiring somebody for the patent group, and I know patent secretaries are very difficult to find. So they've already carved out, the attorneys have already met with this person 3 times. We've all invested time. The more time we've invested, the less likely we are going to be to let this person go. We've already invested enough time, we're down that path. So if we get to that 4th meeting and I'm negotiating salary now, I am not going to stick it over $1,000 or $2,000. If it means that much to that person, plus I want them to start out feeling like they've made the best decision, that they're so lucky to get this job. Yes, we're lucky to have them, but they're lucky to be here. That sort of congenial atmosphere to start with really propels an employment relationship into the right frame.
I agree. I think that so many times on the recruitment end of things, it makes me tickled pink when somebody comes in, because we'll ask job seekers, we'll say, okay, what is your, okay, I'll take that number versus I'm happy versus, oh my gosh, I'm over the moon, tickled pink. And it thrills me as a recruiter when, without even any negotiation on my part or the candidate's part, the employer comes up with a very fair, equitable offer. But on the flip side, sometimes we see it where companies lowball and they can't get away with that anymore in this market for the last 6-7 years, because it was an employer market and there was such an abundance of applicants out there. They're now seeing the repercussions of it.
Well, that's it's cyclical. It's been like that several times during my career. I've seen it that way. And so you just shrug and say, okay, that's the way it is now. So it's like buying homes. You know, it's down, it's up, it's always up. It's up in Los Angeles. But for talent, and I consider everybody who's looking for a job to be talented,
In their own way,
absolutely. They're bringing something unique to the table, hopefully. And I think big firms especially are looking for that person who's going to bring something unique, but that will dovetail in with the group and the department, that fit, that something that you could never really quantify.
A je ne sais quoi,
yes, exactly. I didn't want to pull out my horrible French accent.
I'll leave it up to me.
I have a French friend. He said, I don't know what you're saying right now, but it's not French. So But they, it's very important, that fit. So I try to get to know the people who are asking me to find someone for them to fit into their team. I talk about their team a lot. So I have a generally a very good idea, I think, of who's going to fit well. And whenever when I find that right person, I don't always say this, but when I find that right person, I'll say to the hiring group, oh, this is the one. I'm absolutely certain of it. And because I rarely say that, they always listen.
They trust you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the important thing, is having trust. It's interesting, on the recruitment side, we're seeing a lot of candidates backpedal right now, where they'll tell us one thing, and this is important for anybody listening out there. If you are working for a recruiter is like having an agent or an advocate, and I'm the one interacting with Sharon, and it's my job to represent you. And so, for example, just the other day, we had an applicant who told us, bottom line, she needed $75,000. That was it. I even went back before her initial or her second interview and reconfirmed that they could pay what she wanted, 75. Offer time came around. She's like, oh, I want 78,500. And the client's furious and I'm furious. And so you have to keep in mind, it's like what Sharon just said, it all boils down to trust. Don't work with somebody who you can't trust to be honest with in the first place, and know that you more than likely are going to burn bridges if you change your story. I agree that what you said earlier is important, that there is a certain amount of wiggle room at the end. But if you say, I want X, I want X, I want X, and then when offer time comes around, you say Y, then that's going to leave a bad taste in the employer's mouth.
Well, remember, you're building a relationship. And if you start a relationship with a sour taste in your mouth, you're not starting it on the steadiest footing. And if you're investing your time and effort in a new place, because it's no fun being the new kid on the block, particularly once you've established a reputation at your current position and you know you've worked at two or three different jobs and they've all come to love you, so you know that you're going to get there again, but you want to give yourself the best footing. You don't want to have a stumbling block in the first, before you even start. People already have some sort of feeling about you that's not really what you want to do. Why would you do that? And if you've already had the conversation where you've said, this is what I want, unless you're giving me a cogent reason why, you know, look, I'm sorry, but I got an offer from somewhere else. I really like them.
Yeah.
I think you guys are terrific. I really like you, but that offer is a little sweeter for me. Well, that makes sense to me. That's a negotiation.
It's totally logical, of course.
Yes. But if you lie, and I find out you've lied, you've also corroded the relationship. So, you know, it's always better just to be very fair to each other. You want me to be fair to you, I want you to be fair to me. And when we start out on that footing, I think those are the most excellent building blocks for relationships.
And something else, for those of you listening out there who are in the job market right now and considering making a move, the thing that I find that maybe one out of 10 candidates, it's not something that they're doing intentionally to harm somebody else or the employer, it's actually a lack of knowing. Sometimes you get applicants who haven't changed jobs in 10 years or 15 years, and they don't realize things like they have 401k, profit sharing, PTO time, and a lot of people don't realize it's a huge hourly difference. If you're working a 7-hour day versus a 7.5 versus an 8-hour day, you have to divide the amount of hours you're going to work in a year by that annual salary. Because if you're making $85,000 on a 7-hour day, that comes out to $48 an hour versus $85,000 on an 8-hour day, you're looking at a significant decrease. So you want to make sure to have somebody to bounce all of this off of.
Well, that's why that is the benefit to going through an advocate. If you're doing it for yourself, then you should do the homework that
Absolutely.
Your advocate would have done for you. And by homework, I mean you need to know what your bottom line is. You need to know what your value is. You need to know why. You need to have done all of those calculations ahead of time. You need to ask the right questions, and that those questions include, what is the total comp package? Mm-hmm. Because that includes benefits, what your employer is going to pay toward your benefits and what those benefits are. Does that include parking? What is the parking worth? I mean, an employer looks at each employee's compensation as the total package. This is what it's going to cost me. This
exactly.
is the benefit you get. And the employee often says, well, I'm making 70. In fact, you're making 98.
And people don't realize it
exactly.
until it's too late. And that's where my heart goes out to those people, because the employer has invested time and energy. They've invested time and energy. And I get it, not wanting to take a $20,000 pay cut, but you think you want 70 and it turns out you need 96 or 98. It's a totally different ballgame.
Well, I had somebody say to me fairly recently, I agreed to that, but I did the math wrong, so I really need, and I'm like, really?
Bad judgment.
That's for an accounting position. You're just telling me you're doing the math wrong?
That's a little bit of a red flag. Danger,
yeah,
danger.
I understood. I mean, when you're going from an employer who calculates by annually,
yeah,
and talks about annual salaries, to one that goes weekly, which is what the project-based world does, that you don't really, I don't know. But then, you know, one of the best negotiating tactics you can do if you're unsure of your ground, if you're uncertain of it, and just say, well, I need to think about all of this. Can we go over everything now, and then I'll think about it and get back to you?
Absolutely.
I don't mind that at all. I would rather have somebody go through all of that and then come back to me the next day and say, I understand what you're saying here and here, and these are my points about that. It's fine with me. That's a negotiation.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I get that question asked by a lot of job seekers, and I would love to pick your brain upon this, is when a job seeker gets an offer or gets multiple offers, for you as the employer, what is the appropriate amount of time? Are you willing to wait a week or 2 weeks for somebody else to finish out the other interviews that they're up for? Or is it something that you as an employer expect that if you've gone through the process, you give them an offer, you'll give them 24 or 48 hours? What are your two cents on that?
Depends on the position. If it's a producer, I'm going to give them a couple weeks because the commitment I'm asking of them is a large one. If it's an assistant level or a more junior level, then I think they should have gone through all of this. We've already met 3 times. We've already discussed many points. I think you should have 48 hours max. You must have already thought to yourself, if I got this job, I X, Y, and Z. I mean, we all get caught up in pitching ourselves. You're in the interview, you're having a great time, you're feeling confident, you look great, you can tell that your words are being received properly. You're very excited. So you start selling yourself really hard. And then as you walk down to your car, you think, yeah, I really don't want that job.
Yeah.
So you don't have to pull yourself out of the running. Who knows? But if you get an offer, you already know, because you've had that feeling, yeah, I'm on the fence. There's another one. I think I want to hold out. You can't just keep this person on the hook. Now their postings are getting stale while they're waiting for you. And if you wait too long, if I wait too long for you, and it's been 2 weeks, let's say, because you're waiting for these other bids,
positions, yeah. Mm-hmm. It is what you said.
I have to repost and start all over again. It's not fair to me.
It's a catch-22 situation, because I know what you're saying. Sometimes with the more senior-level jobs and so forth, you do have to allocate depending on the commitment for the job, but it all depends. I do feel like people should know what they want, and one of the things that I talk about in my book, Stop Hoping, Start Hunting, is I talk about creating a wish list, and I think you and I have spoken about this before as well. To be clear to everybody out there, a wish list is something that is everything you're looking for. It works with finding a spouse, with finding a house, with finding a job. I've taught numerous people the wish list method. Now, what most people do, which is one step of the process, is they'll make a list of different things that they want. Like, I want a job paying me $100,000 within 10 miles of my house with XYZ benefits, etc. But the one fine-tuning bit of that I learned many years ago in recruitment is to assign a percentage to each item. So as a job seeker or as somebody searching for a house or a spouse, you could assign a percentage to what is most important, such that if you have 10, 20, or 30 items on your list, the cumulative items add up to 100%. So if salary must be over $100,000, you might give that 15 or 20% of your overall wish list. Or for some people, it's benefits or a flexible work schedule. And the important thing is, once you've gotten all of the little key bits and pieces to add up to 100%, this is where a lot of people don't have an honest conversation with themselves. I believe that we all have a chance to have what we want in life, but getting 100% of exactly what we want, you don't want to be unrealistic. So you want to look at your overall wish list and say, what percentage of my overall wish list needs to be met for me to accept an offer? And if you can do your due diligence before you even get started and bring that wish list with you to any interview, and then after the interview, compare and contrast, then you're not going to wind up in a position where you are like, oh my gosh, is this the right offer? Or even worse, I see so many people get razzle-dazzled. They'll get thrown a lot of money and they take an offer for all the wrong reasons because it's not what they really had their heart set on. So if you have a wish list and you know you want 70% or more of your wish list and a job meets 80%, then there's a strong likelihood that you should move forward with it. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that you have to pay attention to your gut. But sometimes, you know, especially in this market, when employers, they don't want, they're ready. They're ready to pull the trigger. So they want to move forward. So they'll put pressure on you like, well, I need an answer now, or, you know, very quickly. I think that if the candidate walks out so happy, thinking to themselves, oh, that's the dream job, and then by the time they drive home or whatever, that adrenaline
wears
fades
off
a little bit, and then you start thinking, oh, but this traffic on the way driving, this is awful. Oh, I can't imagine doing this every day. Then you have to start taking that into it. So you need to give yourself a little bit of time to really let it settle, and then start thinking, did you like the premises? Did you like the people that you met on the way in? Did they greet you
in
a nice way?
Were
they friendly? And did you feel like this could be a place where you could really flourish and thrive? I want people to thrive. I want our company
exactly.
to thrive, and I want the individuals to thrive. So I think you have to, sometimes that money is a razzle-dazzle, and you think, wow, they're giving me everything I want, and I've
Watch
always
out.
Wanted more money. More money is just awesome. And then you realize more money equals a bigger target
more
on your
expectations.
Back, and more expectations, and not that people don't have high expectations when you start, you joining the firm and the firm of you, but at the same time, I would be a little suspicious if the offer was like 20 grand more than what you were thinking. What are they trying to hide there? What is that money trying to mask?
They're trying to buy something.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you raise. And it leads into one of our next topics I know we were going to talk about, which is twofold. One is what to do once you've gotten the job and how to make sure that you sustain a long and happy and successful, fruitful career there. And it ties into what I was about to say, which is the kiss of death in the offer negotiations stage is entitlement. The minute I have the experience that somebody's getting entitled with me when it comes into an offer, I don't know if you have this experience or if somebody's entitled in the workplace. I have an experience both myself as an employer and as a recruiter that entitlement can be the kiss of death for anybody in their career. What is your thought on that?
It depends on what you mean by entitlement. I mean, at a certain point, you and I both feel entitled within our realms because we've proven ourselves. And so I expect candidates...
Are you calling me out, Sharon?
Maybe a little. But I think that you've earned that sense of entitlement, whereas that's what I look for from the employer side of the table. If somebody's brand new to the workforce, they're coming to me right from college, and they have this list of demands, then I think that entitlement is not based on
anything
more. The
green M&Ms on their desk every
day. Yeah, it's based on wishful thinking rather than reality. But someone who's seasoned and who has had one or two jobs, let's say, and has been in the workforce 2 to 10 years, and they feel entitled to certain things because they know. So I might ask, so they might say to me, let's put it in this terms, if they said to me, it feels a little light, this offer. I think that you're asking me, you're putting me at the low end of your range, maybe. And I believe that I really should reside in the upper end of the range. And here's why. In my last position,
I accomplished X, Y, and Z. I agree. See, that to me, I think that's where the distinction for you and I, for me, that doesn't occur as entitlement. It occurs as, I guess, what would be the word for that? Sharon is much better at words than I am. So perhaps I'm wrong, and the word entitlement does tie into that.
That word is a sort of litmus test right now, because there's a lot of... there's a lot of articles and a lot of talk about the younger
millennials
coming in with senses of entitlement. But I think, you know, baby boomers were seen as being entitled by the group that preceded them. Every group that has been now in the workforce for a few years looks, it's a type of xenophobia, really. You're denigrating the people that are coming up the ladder now. Sheryl Sandberg and Lean In, it's all about extending the hand to somebody else. Just because somebody did it to you, do you need to perpetuate that? I think we all need to be a little friendlier to each other and that kind of thing. We're getting a little off topic, I know. But that all comes as part of it when somebody approaches me, and I guess my back will straighten and I'll look at them a little differently if I feel that entitlement isn't based on anything other than wishful thinking. Sometimes it's just my gut. So then in that case, what I do is I ask them, why do you feel that you're entitled to that?
Mm. And if they can give a logical reason, like you, you know, had mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And so what I know, you especially, you see so many millennials who come into the entertainment field and into animation at the studio that you work with. What do you look for? What are the standout characteristics that would have you want to extend somebody's contract, give them a raise, which we'll finish off this conversation with, or want to grow them within the organization, whether it's been at the animation studio, the real estate company, HBO? What are the key attributes, or what do you look for as somebody's growing their career?
I have artists are very different. It's just a different sort of creative. HBO was very creative, but I was in the legal department there. It was a very creative atmosphere, great company, wonderful people. And at the company I'm at now, it's called Titmouse. It's an animation studio in Hollywood. A lot of our artists are coming directly from school. It's their first or second job. Mm. And they're starry-eyed. They're so excited. It's a wonderful energy. I love this company, and I love the people that are there. That energy is very contagious and wonderful. But one of the things that I've talked to their professors about, who have called me and said, Sharon, what kind of, you've met a lot of our students now, and what kind of classes do you think would help them? And I said, teach them how to fill out forms on their first day. I can't give them tax advice. I can't teach them how to fill out a W-4. And they're on a high point. They're so excited to get the job. And the first thing they're doing is filling out forms and feeling dumb because they don't know how to do it. And so I go out of my way to counsel them. I give them a couple days, call somebody you trust. But I think that if they were armed with that information before they started, they'd just be soaring because they're so happy. What I look for, I have actually had the opportunity at the studio. I met somebody who was applying for an internship, and our internships are unpaid, so they're in college. And she showed me her portfolio. She was so phenomenal, such a phenomenal painter, that after she left, I called a producer that I knew was looking for background painters, and I said, I really want you to see her portfolio. I know she's not exactly ready yet, but if we gave her an internship, you might want to see that as an extended job offer so that as soon as she graduates, you can bring her on board. And she's been with us for 3 more years now, and she's highly sought after every production. There was just something about her and the way she was confident of her skills, but she was very friendly and
approachable.
She would fit in on any team. I mean, we do animation. We do adult animation for Adult Swim. We do children's animation for DreamWorks and Netflix. So an artist who can do everything on any show is very unique. And so when I find those characteristics, I talk to them. Now, other artists come and they say, I only want to do this. And I have sympathy for that. I'm not objecting to that at all. But that means, like in a production, they start with writing, and then they storyboard, and then they design, and then they animate, and then they composite, which is a form of editing. So there is a definite pipeline. And so if somebody is really great at, say, storyboarding, their time on the show is going to end before the people who are editing and compositing. And I've had a couple of the younger artists come to me and say, what can I do to stay on longer? I said, learn how to edit.
Pick up a new characteristic.
Pick up a new skill. And I think that translates to just about any kind of job.
That's a really good point. You're right, because I think for many years it may have been rewarded if you were a very specific specialist, but I think what we're seeing change in the market and shift is that employers are wanting people who can do a little bit of everything, because there might be a lull on a day where, you know, a storyboarder, you might not need them and you need an editor or somebody else. And so I think it's the adaptability factor. I always tell people it's your skills times your attitude that equals your employability, mm-hmm. because it's about being flexible, having a good attitude. Yes, what can I do? How can I help?
Well, we've all met people who are highly skilled. Their skills are just to die for, but they're terrible to be around. They oppress the atmosphere. And sometimes, you know, in times where employees are hard to find, they sort of have the run of the place because nobody wants to say no. It's too hard to replace them or to think about it. But that's not the way the workforce is anymore. Now it's you
fear
really,
based. Like some people are fear based of, oh gosh, I can't replace this person. Everybody is replaceable. I've learned that in the 12 years I've been recruiting. Every person, no matter how great you think you are, you're replaceable.
Mm-hmm. I give this little lecture. I'm sure everyone's, you know, not not thrilled to hear it one more time, but I'm going to say it one more time.
I'm sure our listeners will appreciate it.
I'm a custodian of what I'm doing, and it is for the benefit of the company and the owners of the company. I don't hide things. If I got hit by a bus tomorrow, God forbid, somebody could come in and see exactly where everything is. There are no bombs. There's nothing hidden in my file. But there are still people out there who believe that hiding things, not sharing how to do things, equals job security. I disagree with that that attitude completely.
Yeah. One of the classes that I started leading, with all the shifts in the marketplace, not just in the marketplace at large, but specifically in the legal community, we're noticing huge shifts in the way that law firms use their staff. And so I began leading a class about 3 years ago about the changing role of the legal assistant and the paralegal. And what we came to find out was, if you can shift certain things, it doesn't matter what your job is going to be down the road. It could turn into something completely divergent from what you've been doing the last 5, 10, 15 years. But if you can learn to be the one that others go to for help, be helpful at all times, be the one who your boss trusts to run things when they're out. I mean, I lead this whole 2-hour workshop about it, and it's really empowering, because I remember when I first led this workshop, I had a job seeker who came up to me after the talk, and she was in tears, and she said, "Jennifer, I now realize why I was let go from my last 2 jobs, because it doesn't matter what your title is, what your responsibilities are. It's about always learning, always going above and beyond, being proactive rather than reactive, making your boss's life easier. And if you can do all of that, A, you're going to go home and go to bed and sleep easier, and you're always going to have job security, because those are the people, irrespective of duties or title, who are always going to be employable. And we see it happen even when the economy was at its worst, 2009 to 2014, we were still seeing the good candidates always got hired, and it came down
or never got let go.
You're absolutely right. And I tell job seekers that. Just today I was interviewing a candidate, and she's been with the company for close to 10 years. Really great. And she's just now in a position where she's starting to look. And I said, you know, it says a lot about you that you're in a law firm and you were kept employed in your department from 2009 to 2014.
Absolutely.
Mentioned that in interviews. She was the last one in her department, last one left standing. So that really says a lot about your credibility.
Well, yes, I've had even the artists at the studio will ask me, how can I ensure that the producers will want me back versus anybody else? And it's not about, you know, trying to race and beat somebody. It's about how can I get on that list? And I said, don't give them any problems. Producers' lives are about problems. They're problem solvers. And if you get a certain amount of footage or you get a certain amount of scenes assigned to you, then make sure you fulfill your assignment.
Just do your
job.
Those
are the ones that people that don't give them any problems. The people who come in and say, you know what, I have to come in a little late today, and then tomorrow I'm going to leave a little early, but I'll make it up on the weekend. Okay, we could do that a little bit, but if you do that every week, then it creates this feeling of distrust and chaos, and, you know, and I think it's the same from what I remember in law firms. You know, you have deadlines, and if you're not there, sometimes if the assistant isn't there, the attorney is hamstrung. They're hoping for a floater, or they're begging somebody at the next carol, because a floater sometimes has to be trained in their little area, whatever it is, to be able to jump in and flourish. I mean, a lot of smart firms have floaters that they just assign, so they're all very well versed in the firm culture. But any time there's a shift, the progress of the supervisor or the superior, however you want to put that, stutters. That time is money to the firm.
Yeah.
So, yes, and productivity is money. You have to look at it from, I mean, it's all very well and good to look at it from what you need, and that is a viable position. But if you incorporate into what you need a knowledge and understanding of what your employer needs, you are going
to
be more valuable.
Yeah, you'll thrive and you'll be more valuable. It's interesting, because what you made me think of too is, in the class I teach on how to be indispensable in the workplace, one of the things I talk about is the quickest ways to get fired, let go, or not get hired if you're contracting, whether it's in a corporation, a law firm, or even in a studio. And that is blaming, justifying, defending, or complaining. And in fact, when I leave this class, there's a little simple exercise that can give us all great insight into how we occur for other people, be it personally, professionally, romantically. And I give people this exercise. I say, I want you to go home, and for 1 week, I want you to take your iPhone, your Samsung, whatever you might have, or a piece of paper and a notepad, and I want you to make a tick, you know, like those little ticks you would put on a prison wall, and I want you to put one down for every time you blame someone, every time you justify, every time you complain about something, or every time you defend. And it was an eye-opener even for me when somebody once gave me this exercise about 8 or 9 years ago, because I realized that I'm not perfect. I complain and I justify, but part of it is bringing consciousness and awareness to it, because if that's your default, is one of those four things, you're not going to be employed as long as the other person. It's the people who come in, like you said, they don't create drama, they don't create problems, they anticipate needs and concerns.
Well, I'm not advocating anybody being a doormat, because I think that that creates hostility, and that's a bad thing. But I think that what you're saying about self-knowledge and understanding, a real clear-eyed assessment of your habits is never a waste, if you're really looking at it that way.
Not in a blame or victim sort of way, of like, oh my gosh.
But I just wanted to say that there, all of us have this, I think it's a human trait, that's not fair. And we always say,
so
you know,
true.
That's such a child thing. But I think that drive to justify comes from, look, I'm the oldest of 10 kids. So I was always held responsible for the actions of the other ones because I was the oldest. And I just thought that was so unfair. And I would have these arguments with my mother. I don't have the power to make them or make them do or not do something. So how can I be held responsible? Well, your position is that you are responsible. So better keep an eye on them.
So be responsible.
Yes, I was lieutenanted into that kind of pyramid. But I think that is what drives that need to respond in that way if you feel attacked. And let's say our supervisors, our managers don't always
have good management skills.
Yes, exactly. They're not good managers. They don't know the right way to talk to you. But if you, no matter what your position is, if you can turn that around and create a dialogue, or if there's steam coming out of their ears, there's no dialogue happening.
Just give them space.
Yes. So if you try to defend yourself because you feel like, oh, my ground is really steady, I know I can tell them this and they'll understand, it's not the right time. You're not going to get through to them in that. You have to really look at the nuances in the atmosphere and pay attention. So I think you really have to pay attention.
It's the emotional intelligence as well, I think, is really important.
That Daniel Goleman book is outstanding.
Oh, yeah. I think you even bought it for me, mm-hmm. or gave me a copy of it. And I remember years ago, I was actually getting ready to lead one of these classes, and I'll never forget it. I'm running in for this speech. I get a call. It's 4:00. I shouldn't have answered my phone. The speech was at 4:15, and it's from an irate client. Jennifer, blah, 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 was supposed to be here 15 minutes ago. Where is she? What's going on? I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't need this. I have a speech. So I called the recruiter in charge of the applicant, and he was amazing. And I said, you know, what happened? Where is she? And he said, Jen, I screwed up. She called me at 7:30 this morning. She said she had pneumonia, and I didn't tell you. It will never happen again. You have my word. And in my life, I have never been more proud, because I was just so appreciative of his honesty and his willingness to take responsibility. We're going to screw up. We're human. Mm-hmm. It's not the end
of
the world.
Perfect.
Life is going to go on. I was able to tell the client that. We did lose her for about 6 months and she came back around, but I really respected and admired his willingness to just say, I screwed up. You have my word. It won't happen again. And I did learn to trust his word.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of it. The senior person has to create an atmosphere of trust so that people can come forward with mistakes and not feel
that they're going to be reamed or
a castigation is one thing, but a reaming is something else. And if you create the atmosphere where people are frightened
fear.
To tell you the truth, then they're going to bury the problem. You're not going to find out about it. By the time you do discover it, it's going to be huge. And by the way, the employee is not doing this to screw up or to screw you or anything like that. They're doing that because they don't want to get in trouble. They want to fix it for you. They don't want to be seen as somebody that's not doing the right thing. It just creates a really terrible atmosphere. So even if as a supervisor you lash out initially, then because of the anxiety you're under or whatever, And I've worked with many lawyers like this, but the ones that I really were devoted to were the ones that came back and said, I'm really sorry. I was just under the gun. It really bothers me that this happened, but please assure me it's never going to happen again. Absolutely. And I would fall all over myself for those people. And
just to take response, exactly. As opposed to the people, and this is the number one reason we hear of people looking to leave jobs is being, you know, having bosses who are jerks, who yell,
denigrate
who scream.
Them. Yeah,
and
nobody wants that.
And again, I was not the best manager. I'll take full responsibility. For anybody listening out there who worked with me back when I first opened, I knew nothing about management. And I just thought everybody would miraculously be able to read my mind. And thank God, years of self-development classes and good mentors like you, and I've learned how to become a better manager. But it's all about going, okay, we're all going to have our reactionary moments, whether you're the supervisor or the employee. And it's about taking responsibility, even if you're the supervisor, like you just said, and say, you know what, shoot, I didn't mean to come across that way. Here's what didn't work. How can we remedy this and move forward?
And take a breath.
Allow
take
a breath.
Take a breath and reorient yourself. That inner dialogue has to be clear. You have to what's my larger goal here? Am I trying to get this done? Alienating somebody who's key to me accomplishing my goal is not the way to do it, you know, and that can be from the subordinate or the superior position. It doesn't really matter. It's all about we're people. We're all trying to make a living. We're all trying to work towards a goal.
A common goal. And
we want to feel happy about ourselves when we leave at the end of the day. I believe in respect. I believe
in mutual respect.
Mutual respect. And that's what I said about doormats. I think you can be respectful and leave people their dignity.
I think that's
either
a beautiful way to put it. So let's say, to bring the conversation full circle, that you've negotiated your salary and now you've been in this job for a year, 3 years, 5 years, and perhaps you even got hired in 2009 or 2010. How would you encourage somebody to approach asking for a raise? This is a super common question I get asked, especially right now in the marketplace. What would you tell somebody to do if they're being, if they feel that they're undervalued or underpaid for the marketplace? How would you respond to that as an employer?
First of all, I would want to hear from somebody who says to me, I've done some research. In my position in Los Angeles, at a studio or a law firm of this size, the typical range is from here to here. I looked on Glassdoor. I looked on
Payscale,
Salary.com. I talked to recruiters. I wanted to be sure. So that reassures the person they're taking it seriously, not, hey, I haven't had a decent raise in 4 months, and I really want, that's not going to go. That's not going to fly. But somebody who's been there and you were there in 2009, you took the hit in your salary, and you stayed because you are,
loyal.
So that pays for something. That loyalty is meaningful. So I would say that once you make your point, you make that pitch, first of all, it's a very emotional thing for a lot of people to ask for money. So learning the right way to do that is critical. One way to do it is to speak to your reflection in a mirror. How do you look?
Oh.
Because are your physical responses in line with what you're trying to do?
Are you coming across confident, using strong body poses?
Are you wringing your hands? Are your eyebrows up around your hairline? You just want to be calm. You want to present the right demeanor. So I would say, first, to your mirror. Second, rehearse it with a friend whom you trust, who will listen to you and really listen to you and not make fun of you, because they want to make a
it's
joke
vulnerable.
Of it because, yes, you're making yourself vulnerable with that. So it has to be somebody you trust. So you talk to them, and they, when they give you critique, it should be, yeah, I kind of got the feeling you were begging a little bit there.
Yeah.
That's not what you want to do. You don't want to. So then now you've refined it. You've rehearsed it a couple of times. Now the thing is, you know your situation better. You know your employer, your supervisor. Does your supervisor have to take it to their supervisor to get it okayed? Is it coming at the time of your regular raise? Is this company one that only gives raises on the anniversary date?
Oh.
If you're asking for it midway through that, you have an uphill battle. So you better that argument. You better marshal all your defenses and your arguments for that to bring it to them, because knowledge is power. Knowing that they're going to have to argue, you need to arm them for their further argument. But if it's, let's say it's at your annual, you're saying, my annual review is coming up, and I am determined that I want to make up some lost ground, so I want to make sure that they're evaluating this. A lot of big companies have a
tier
ceiling
system, yeah.
They have a ceiling, but how much of a raise they can give in a year. That's not to say that your supervisor doesn't have some kind of leeway. So what you want to do is give them the material that they need to say,
go to their higher
yeah,
ups.
The reason I think Gracie needs more is because, you know, she stayed with us during 2009 where we loaded her up because we just didn't have the funds to have as many assistants as we needed.
So true.
Now we have as many assistants and the new ones are coming in at a higher rate. I really don't think she should be punished.
And she's training them.
I really don't think she should be punished for being loyal to us and helping us hold down the fort when we needed it the most. So I think she's given me numbers that I've looked at and understand are correct, and now I really want to fight for this. Now, your supervisors fighting for you, that is going to be key. They may still not win, but that will make you feel like even if they don't do it, you're at the right place. People yeah. care about you. They
you have
recognize
an internally
yes,
for you.
They've
That's
recognized
huge.
The value of what you're doing, and that might they might say, I can only give you this much now, but they're going to really up your bonus, and they promise me they're going to do that, and you know whatever that dialogue is. But once you open that dialogue, once you start talking about this, you have to see it through. You can't kind of half-ass it. You got to go for it. So make sure you have your arguments, your rehearsals,
your evidence
under
That's
your
so
belt
important.
So you're ready.
I always tell people that when they go into interview for another job, and the same is true when you're internally either applying for a job or trying to get a raise, it's all about giving examples of what I call your PEP, P-E-P, productivity, efficiency, and performance. And I have found if somebody, even within my own organization, has come to me and said, Jen, here's what I did. I increased these numbers. I accomplished X, Y, and Z, I am always more than willing to sit down and go, absolutely, you're right. Let's talk about this. Would we rather increase your base? Would we rather increase your commission? Because I think it's important to keep people motivated. But like we had said before, if somebody comes in and this is where people really hurt themselves and they're not being indispensable, like one of my dear friends oversees 10 direct reports, and this person came in and said to her, you know, I want a raise. I deserve it. I'm a single mom. I'm hardworking. And my heart goes out. I can't imagine, you know, what it's like to be a single mom, but that's not the way to get a raise, let alone the fact that this person had been late 5 times in the last 2 weeks and had lied on her time card. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not somebody who's trustworthy...
She still had a job after she lied on her time
we're
card?
We're not going to talk about that, but...
Wow.
but yes.
And now so, she's asking for a raise, well.
Yeah, so that person may have or may not have left the company already. Mm-hmm. But it's important to understand that actions speak louder than words. And so if you're doing the work and you're showing up and you're producing the results, I find that will be rewarded whether or not you have to be the one to bring it up, or oftentimes I notice employers will be the one to notice it themselves and want to reward good behavior.
Oftentimes they don't. They'll wait for you to bring it up.
You think so? I live in a world where everybody's good.
I wish. No, sometimes they just wait. They forget about it. You're doing a great job. But sometimes what happens is, you know they love you. You know that they, but they've forgotten about your raise and they're forcing you to ask. And so then now you have an attitude and as it gets kind of curdled and you want to make sure you don't do that. You don't want to act out of that anger or anxiety or whatever. You take a deep breath.
Don't be reactive.
Don't
be proactive.
Absolutely. Jen's very great with that. She's good coaching with that.
Well, you're one of my favorite mentors, and I'm so happy that we've had you on the show today. Do you have any, I know we have a couple minutes left here, any last parting thoughts that you would love to share with our listeners about how to negotiate a raise or to get their dream job?
I have actually a couple of, I'm all about reading, as you
okay.
know.
Okay. Oh, I know you have so many great resources. Please do share.
I have a couple of them. I love Harvard Business Review, even okay. if it's not exactly on point for what you're looking for. What it does is get you in the mindset of what it's like to be a member of a company that's, you know, that's trying to carve new ground or do the same things but better and all of that. It just gets you in that mode. And they also have a section called HBR Books, which are collections of several on-topic articles, and one of them is called Managing Yourself.
Oh.
So it's like managing your career, managing, so that, I found that very... But here are a couple books that I just find wonderful launching points. They're called Crucial Conversations, tools for talking when stakes are high, and crucial confrontations, tools for resolving broken promises, violated expectations, and bad behavior.
Do you know who the author is on either of those?
The both of them are the same group of authors. It's a team. Carrie Patterson, Joseph Grenie, Ron McMillan, Al Switzler. They are down to earth. They give case studies, but if you don't find your exact issue in this book, you're going to find something close. And what they are launching points so that you get started thinking in that mode, and they give you really great down to earth advice.
Awesome. That's perfect, which is a perfect segue to our guest next week, Paul Falcon, world-renowned HR business leader. He actually used to work at NBC Universal in their HR department and has written 8 best-selling books. And next week on the show, tune in at 4 p.m., he'll even be talking about his latest book, which I believe is about to come out. And he's going to give some examples of how to get employed once you've been in the military and to transition in that way. So tune in next week at 4 p.m. Today, we've had Sharon O'Donnell on the show, and you're listening to Jennifer Hill with Get Yourself the Job. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you, Sharon, for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.